The 1995 Sandstone Symposium presents session number 214, Schindler in Reverse, or What Mattereth Man Among 9 Million, with papers by David Pace, McConkie and Dad, Memories, Dreams, and Rejection, and How to Read Bad News by Janice Allred.
Early to be up and about. It's time to start. My name is Marty Jones, and I'm chairing this session. On behalf of the Mormon Alliance, we'd like to welcome you out and thank you for your support. Before we begin, there are a couple of things that we'd probably like to say on behalf of the Alliance. As Janice will be discussing in a little bit more detail, we are looking forward to the first case reports publication that will be book format or journal format case reports of spiritual abuse in the LDS Church. As I said, Janice will be speaking more about that topic. Her paper, which will be the second presentation today, is actually the initial or one of the beginning articles for that book entitled How to Read Bad News. She will speak on the effects of reading the kinds of horrible stories or... It always is interesting because it's less horrifying sometimes to the people who actually go through abusive situations than it is to those who hear about it. But she will be discussing those implications and ramifications. Janice is, to begin and go backwards, a mother, theologian, scholar, and member of the expanding non-member Mormon church. Our first speaker, David Pace, has written for the American Theater Magazine, Theater Week, and the Christian Science Monitor. His work has appeared locally in several magazines. He is a theater critic. For 9 years, he was a theater critic for first the Private Eye and then the Event newspapers. A flight attendant for Delta Airlines for the past 10 years, David is relocating next month to Brooklyn, New York, to be closer to the theaters, with his wife, Cheryl, who is also a journalist. David will speak on the secondary, as opposed to Janet's topic of tertiary effects, secondary effects of abuse on someone close to you and the impact that that has on a family particularly. To anyone who was on the Brigham Young University campus in the early 1980s, the core abusive situation that David will be talking about is not unknown. I did not actually attend that particular religious, I can't remember what it was. It was a devotional. I didn't actually attend that devotional, but I did run into one faculty member friend of mine immediately after when the bookstore opened in the religion section, flipping through madly Dr. Pace's book, saying, "I know he made a direct quote from this book. I know he did." There's no question who Elder McConkie's comments were directed to. Finally, before beginning, we would like to recognize in this public place the with resignation our board members this past spring, Aaron Silva, Margaret and Paul Toscano, and Fred Voros. Speaking on behalf of the board, we will miss them. We have greatly appreciated everything that they have done to work with and help develop, to establish and set up the fundamental principles and the reasons for which the Mormon Alliance exists and will continue to exist. Thank you.
I had the experience of probably a lot of speakers at the symposium this year of having a title that doesn't necessarily jive with my comments, but so be it. My father climbs mountains. Every year he takes several members of the family to the top of Mount Timpanogos. Sometimes we stay overnight at Emerald Lake. But most often, we start out early, climb to the top, eat lunch, and then slide down the glacier on our way back down. Our feet become terribly sore, and our butts get bruised on rocks that have settled below the surface of the snow. But we go back every year anyway, or so it seems. Dad climbs other mountains as well, Mount Rainier, Mount Hood, the Matterhorn. One year he climbed the Grand Teton. The name makes him blush now that my brother has told him what it means in French, but he still talks about that trip. The pictures he brought back show him in sunglasses on the summit, the murky valleys floating below, in a static realm far away. I can imagine what it might have been like for him because of my own trips to the top of Timp. The air is thin and heady. The world sits below like an impressionist oil. But you can hear the gentle, far-off chawing of its gears, like a distant steel mill on a quiet evening. When I went on a mission to eastern Massachusetts, I realized what a mountain could mean because there weren't any. Just miles and miles of trees and winding little streets that burrowed about madly from place to place. I could never see where I was. You need a mountain so that you know where you are. It's a point of reference that gives everything some meaning, like a lost human artifact does to a vacant field. One time, my missionary companion, who was also from the Rockies, climbed a tall tree behind our apartment. He told me what he could see and grumbled about the Unitarians because he could see their church, but not ours. Ours was too squatty. I had always thought that Mormons should build meeting houses like New England churches, at least in Massachusetts, with steeples that rose to the occasion, steeples that missionaries could at least see from the tops of trees. But I'm getting ahead of myself. When I was growing up, Dad climbed the mountain that rose sharply across the street from our house nearly every morning. He had a little spot about 20 minutes up the hill where he liked to go to pray out loud. It was a thing with him, to pray out loud, as if it helped break some ozone barrier to God. On Saturdays, he would go to his retreat during the day after he'd cleaned the garage or mowed the lawn. If we needed him, we would honk the horn a few times until he would barely appear on the ridge above us and wave. One evening when I was 17, he invited me to go up to the prayer spot with him. Because there was still snow, we took little corner pillows with us from grandmother's old couch, which sat half-eaten by mice in the garage. It was cold, and a nearly full moon cast shadows through the scrub oak. I put my pillow down on a rock and sat on it. Dad went somewhere else, and I listened for his prayer, but I didn't hear anything. Perhaps for the first time I felt a sense of mystery about my father. A communion was going on that was too sacred for me to witness. Although I felt safe, I also felt troubled, restless, wondering what a mountain prayer could possibly mean to me. Another time, Dad didn't come back from climbing until my mother thought he was dead. At 8 in the morning, he had started hiking, and one ambition had led to another. He decided to go to the top. It took him until 2 p.m. to go up and back, and when he returned, there were cars from the Forest Service in the driveway, and the ward was about ready to start fasting. My mother wouldn't speak to him for a while after that. I think she really thought he was dead. Sometimes my father, who taught at Brigham Young University from 1969 to 1993, would take his classes up to the prayer spot where they would have testimony meetings. He looked like Charlton Heston to me, but shorter, laboring Moses-like up the hill and around the corner until he was out of sight, a ribbon of panting students close behind. When they got on top of the ridge, my siblings and I could see the students' heads scattered about, rising and then sitting one at a time. When we got tired of watching, we would go inside and sneak refreshments that sat on the kitchen table, calling to us. As I got older, I became embarrassed. by my father's eccentric spirituality. It was becoming common knowledge in our ward and the campus stake where he was president that my father took to the mountains for prayers. Some people didn't like the idea of a lot of verbal prayer, a lot of prayer, period. At the critical threshold of adulthood, the whole concept made me nervous as well. It was the same feeling I used to get when an older ward member would explain in fast meeting that she had seen a spirit in her bedroom the week before. My father's reputation preceded me at BYU. By 1979, he was teaching over 1,500 students per semester and was also a popular lecturer throughout much of the church. At BYU, spirituality becomes codified and competitive, and I got negative vibes from other students, even professors who disdained him and thought that he, however popular, was naive. Spending long hours praying in the mountains was okay for Enos and Nephi. But there seemed to be something excessive, even lame, about someone doing it in our day. At least he should keep quiet about it. That was the sentiment. The stigma of my father's daily rendezvous with the mountain was reinforced by my sense of being humored by others because of it. I felt I wasn't being taken seriously, and nothing seemed worse to a college freshman than not to be taken seriously by those in academe who fancied themselves in academe. There were many who admired my father's spiritual life, but I began dismissing those who would tell me what a wonderful dad I had and how he had positively affected their lives. They were silly and emotional, groupies suffering from excessive zeal. It was hard being the son of Moses. For one thing, and this would never have occurred to Dad's disciples, Moses is never around. He's too busy being Moses. After a year at college, when I was called on a mission to mountainless New England, where a Utah has to climb trees to get his bearings, Dad sent me a copy, hot off the press, of his book, What It Means to Know Christ. I was pretty proud of him. I knew that the volume with the somewhat lurid cover of a woman looking up into the face of the risen Lord contained his story, every meaningful spiritual experience he'd had since he was a 19-year-old farm boy reading the Book of Mormon while he irrigated Idaho's sugar beets. And I was in mountainless New England in November 1981, and Bruce R. McConkie had just given his infamous relationship to Christ speech, and I called home at Thanksgiving, and Dad cried. Not that tears were unusual. He'd always been expressive. But he was weeping out of a place that was deep and unknown to him. Perhaps if I had been in Utah, I would have done something rash, something only to regret later. I don't know. At a multi-stake fireside, McConkie, an apostle of the church, had spoken pointedly of those like my father who emphasized Christ in their theology. McConkie poo-pooed it. Dad, seated at the podium as stake president, had not been forewarned of the attack. Exactly what the point of contention was between the two men was unclear, but its effect was devastating to Dad, which is where devastation in the church usually settles, that is, with the individual. Dad didn't know what to do, and neither did I. When I spoke with him again over the phone the following March, he didn't weep. He spoke soberly, numbly. At a BYU devotional, Elder McConkie, in his characteristic brazen style, had continued the corrective, quoting Dad's book and calling it, quote, pure sectarian nonsense, unquote. My father took his book off the market. He was released from his job as stake president. Approximately 50% of his class enrollment disappeared, as rumors, even of the excommunication of George Pace, circled BYU like buzzard's breath. In the mission field, bad news from home is an open sore, a sore that a young man takes to be his personal wound. It was as though Elder McConkie's remarks were directed to me, and every aspersion that seemed cast toward my father afterwards seemed to have been cast at me. My earlier ambivalence toward my father's spiritual flamboyance collapsed into blood loyalty. After the second phone call to my father, I avoided turning my missionary flip chart to the photo of the 12 apostles during discussions. I didn't want to broker an image of Bruce McConkie. "Elder," intoned my mission president in a tearful interview, "no offense, but if your father was disciplined by one of the brethren, he probably needed disciplining." I finished my mission. I went home, and things were different. My faith thinned until it seemed non-existent. I had a target for my cynicism. No one could tell me that I didn't have a good reason to question the church because no one seemed to understand McConkie's position, which seemed to contradict the direction of so many other church doctrines. No one had an explanation, and no one was willing to publicly speculate. There seemed to be nowhere to go with my anger at the church hierarchy, so I lashed out at my parents. Outwardly, they remained loyal to the church, even though I knew they were full of anguish and confusion. Privately, some general authorities said comforting things to my father, but I wanted Dad to strike back, to demand a public explanation and/or an apology. I remember that first year after my mission as the darkest our family had experienced up to that time. I saw my parents as living corpses. My mother became ill. My father lost weight. My brother left for his mission to painful testimonies at a lifeless farewell. For almost 2 years, every family conversation degenerated into the unresolved confusion and anger that stemmed from this encounter with Christ's special witness. The summer ended, and I got ready to go back to BYU, ready like a bat out of hell. On an August night, I had just come home from work. My mother and younger sisters were all sitting on the front porch in the dark. I was somewhat relieved to know that Dad wasn't there. We couldn't talk, because everything always turned to the incident. Mostly, I tried to ignore him. I remember that the night was mellow and fragrant, and that the front door had been left open to cool off the house. Because of mosquitoes and moths, Mom always insisted that the porch lights stay off. Still, it seemed eerie that they were all sitting there in the dark, their voices muffled by the rustling leaves of nearby trees. I sat down on the porch step, my mother's rigid white feet next to me. She was in her robe, and the girls were all in their pajamas. "You got here just in time," my mother said. "We're waiting for your father to signal us." "Signal you?" I asked. "Where is he?" She pointed up toward the dark outline of the hulking mountain in front of us. "Up there. He's staying overnight on the summit." "Well, I'm glad he told you this time," I said. "Yes," she half whispered, sensing my sarcasm. I looked about at my three sisters, freshly bathed in pajamas, sitting in a quiet wonder. "I let them stay up late so they could see the signal. I hope he's all right up there," she added. I sighed. "So he's still climbing," I thought. I don't know that he had ever stopped as I thought about it, but I guess it was me. I was the one who hadn't climbed for a long time. I had forgotten about the mountains. I couldn't remember why we hadn't climbed Timpt that summer. It's amazing how you can spend a whole year in the Rockies and not really notice them. In the past, they had been such a powerful reassurance to me, but that year, they had been only jagged, crumbling things, slowly eroding into the valley. The thought of my father up there made me feel strangely uncomfortable and yet oddly respectful at the same time. For a minute, all of us fell silent. Our minds seemed to have wandered from the mountain as we secretly watched two runners jog by, talking. They didn't know that in the shadows we were all listening to them. Then suddenly there was a squeal from one of the little ones. "Hey, look, Mommy, there it is." Above us on the very highest peak was a tiny fire. We all stared in awe at the speck of light that continued to grow bigger and bigger until it seemed to light up the entire peak in a soft, irregular glow. "He's going to burn the mountain down," my mother gasped. "Yes," I thought absently, "the mountain is going to burn right down. The whole damn thing in one huge, resentful conflagration. How wonderfully devastating." I thought this with rising ire, like man's puny arm pulling the one pin that would deflate the whole of God's universe. But the fire spread no further. The silhouette of pines slowly died down, as did the voices of my sisters, who were now no longer piqued with excitement, but lost in a trance-like gaze, thinking of more distant things, like perhaps the loneliness in a dark world, the loneliness on top of a windy mountain at night. Well, it was sad sitting there, all of us thinking of the night and our father high above us next to a now smoldering fire. But suddenly there was a flash of light, a tiny, precise stream of light piercing down to us. And then another, and another. He had a flashlight, and he was blinking it at us. "Quick, go get a flashlight," said my mother, jumping up out of her chair. "We've got to let him know we saw him," she said to me. "We've got to let him know." It was one of those spontaneously motivated things, I suppose. I didn't have time to think of any implications. It just happened. I began searching through kitchen drawers, cupboards, even the hutch. I searched frantically, tearing into this and that like a child looking for something precious but lost. I couldn't find one anywhere. Soon I was panting from the excitement and my voice was cracking under a whispered prayer. "Oh, dear God, where's a flashlight? Where's a flashlight? He's got to know. He's got to know." I ran back through the front hall. Everyone was screaming excitedly, except my mother, who stood tensely looking up, her hands held tightly under her chin. "The porch lights," I thought. "We can use the porch lights." I ran to the switch and began blinking them off and on. "Wait," my mother said. I stopped. There was a pause. "On," she said. I flipped the lights on. "Off," I flipped them off. "On, off, on, off," she continued. On top of the mountain, the light continued blinking at us in sync with the porch lights. My sister squealed. "He sees us. He sees us, Mommy. Daddy sees us." The year of my divorce found my father and me trekking in the Himalayas. As we descended into a valley that cradled what seemed at dusk to be an idyllic Nepalese village, we spotted our Sherpa guide's familiar campfire. I turned to my father and wondered if I knew him. His response to the McConkie incident nearly 10 years earlier was to profess his support for the brethren and to view his pain as stemming from some Abrahamic test that a God as cruel as Elder McConkie, in my view, had sent him to endure. And since I didn't share my father's highly literal belief in a personal Jesus anymore, I felt isolated from him. Here's the fix I was in. Mormonism and family closeness had been indelibly fused for me. There were no distinctions made between certainty of belief in the gospel according to Joseph Smith and family loyalty. I also wondered if Dad could ever know me, or if T.S. Eliot was right when he said that you can't understand what one believes until you believe it yourself. I wonder if the same works for disbelief, my rejection of Orthodox Mormonism. How could my father understand my disbelief until he had experienced it as I had? I wondered if the ties that bound a Mormon family together were flexible enough to weather the violent delineations that inevitably occur between family and faith as children mature into adulthood, mature into belief, and in my case, into disbelief. Today, I don't think those bonds are flexible enough. We stood there on a 19,000-foot peak called Kalapatar, which overlooks Mount Everest with its flume of wind-blown snow trailing off into the stratosphere. "This is like living in the church," I told my father wearily through the lightheadedness and nausea that is often common at that altitude. "It's like a trek that never descends from this rarefied air." He leaned into his walking stick, listening. "I don't know," I continued. "It's like you plod through your whole life just to find that when you reach what you thought was the top, there's another ridge, and the whole time you feel lousy, like right now." My father smiled, a thin, almost goofy grin breaking the gray of his grizzled 14-day beard. He was so familiar to me at that moment, in his silly blue hat, but in a distance kind of way, like the Sherpa's muted fire warming below us. He said nothing, but I thought, as we swayed together in a deoxygenated delirium, that this uncertainty was the way it was supposed to be, the way it had to be, and that it was all underwritten by God's terrible honesty. There seem right now to be only two ways of dealing with the human condition. We can deny the painful parts, thereby guaranteeing their eternal life through our progenitors, or we can grapple with them, get bruised, and run the risk of becoming morbidly obsessed. Transcending pain appears evasive to both those who deny pain and abuse, like the McConkie incident, and those who, like myself, continue to wrestle with the demons that it has spawned. Maybe that's why my father still climbs his mountains through thin air. Perhaps he is trying to convince himself that he is better because of McConkie's hatchet job. And indeed, he is better, if Nietzsche was right when he wrote that what doesn't kill us makes us stronger. And maybe that's why I insist on sitting in the valley below, banging my head against the maddening silent treatment dispensed by the Bride of Christ, who nevertheless has balls enough to proclaim with sanctimonious regularity that she is the only true and living church on the face of the whole earth. Even so, I continue to look for signals from my Father, and I hope that he can see mine.
Is spiritual abuse a private matter? Does it only affect the person that it happens to? I don't think so. Thank you, David, for telling us your story. I don't think that we can understand the full dimensions of spiritual abuse until we have heard the stories of those that have been abused. As Marty has said, one of the ongoing projects of the Mormon Alliance is the collection and publication of stories of spiritual abuse. And all of the members of the board, the trustees, have agreed that this is indeed our most important project. Our first volume is scheduled to be published, I think, in November. And the paper I'm going to read you today is the introduction to this volume. I wrote this in January of 94, before I knew that I was going to be one of the cases in the first volume. Listening to David was a very poignant experience for me as I thought about how my being disciplined by the church has affected my own children. I don't know exactly what ramifications it will have in their life. We've talked about it, but they have, of course, not been able to express all their feelings to me, as children never are able to do that to their parents. I will read you exactly what I wrote. Consider yourself readers of the volume of case studies, stories of spiritual abuse. These stories are bad news, and we realize that it will be painful to read them. We know this because as we have listened to these people tell their experiences, we ourselves have felt some of their pain. We anticipate that the reactions of our readers will range from disbelief to anger to sorrow, which are the natural reactions to pain. Disbelief will come from those who believe that such things could not happen in the Church of Jesus Christ. These people will want to ignore the problem. Anger will come from those who recognize that someone has been hurt by someone else. The purpose of anger is to identify the offense and name the offender. Those who are angry will want to do something about the problem. Those who feel sorrow will look at and feel all the dimensions of the pain in empathy with both the victims and the abusers. Those who feel sorrow want to promote forgiveness and reconciliation. We think that many people will feel all these reactions simultaneously or in sequence to different degrees and in different ways over time. We cannot escape our own pain, but it requires courage and an open heart to be willing to feel the pain of others. Feeling and accepting the pain of others can be both easier and more difficult if we have had similar experiences. Easier because we understand the pain, but more difficult if we have not worked through it. Although no one wants to feel pain, pain is not in itself bad. Physiologically, the purpose of pain is to warn us that something is wrong with our body so that we can fix it if possible. Mental and emotional pain may be more complex, but behind all pain is a problem or problems that can be worked on if not completely solved. Pain invites us to ask, what is the problem? What is the cause of the problem? And how can the problem be solved, ameliorated, or at least worked on? We have identified the problem in these cases as spiritual abuse. Spiritual abuse, like all kinds of abuse, takes place in a relationship where individuals have unequal power. The principle of human equality underlies the concept that some actions should be considered abusive. Making this assumption explicit, we can state the prescription of abuse as a moral imperative. Because all people have equal value, Whenever someone in a relationship has more power than the other person, he or she should use that power to benefit rather than to exploit or abuse the other person. When ecclesiastical leaders use their power in arbitrary and coercive ways to serve their own or the institution's perceived interests at the expense of the spiritual needs and rights of the members involved in spiritual abuse, it does not matter that they say that it is for the person's benefit and or growth. It does not matter if the victim believes that the leader must be right. The effect is still abuse. The gospel of Christ mandates spiritual equality. Spiritual equality does not mean that all are equal in spiritual power or intelligence, nor does it mean that all have the same spiritual gifts or callings. It does mean that we are all equally valuable in God's sight. All are alike unto God. 2 Nephi 26:33. Through the atonement, Jesus made himself equal to every human being because he gave his life for each of us. Spiritual equality means that everyone should have equal access to spiritual gifts and equal opportunities to express those gifts in a service to others. Although all members do not possess the same gifts, the purpose of the gifts is to benefit everyone. To some is given one, and to some is given another, that all may be profited thereby. In section 78 of the Doctrine and Covenants, the Lord teaches that in his church we must be equal in obtaining heavenly things. Finally, spiritual equality means that each person is responsible and accountable for his or her own sins and spiritual growth. How may this spiritual equality be respected when there are inequalities in church structure as well as in spiritual gifts and callings? These inequalities do not in themselves constitute spiritual abuse, but they can lead to it. Section 121 of the Doctrine and Covenants explains that spiritual power or authority is used abusively whenever we use it to cover our sins, or to gratify our pride or ambition, or to exercise control, dominion, or compulsion upon any person in any degree of unrighteousness. This means that compulsion can never be used righteously, although it can be exercised in varying degrees of unrighteousness. The powers of heaven operate without compulsory means. They influence by persuasion, long-suffering, gentleness, meekness, love, kindness, knowledge, and righteous chastisement, invariably coupled with an increase of love. In considering whether spiritual abuse has taken place or is taking place, we need to ask, is ecclesiastical or priesthood authority being used to cover the sins or weaknesses of the leader? Is the leader using his, or more rarely her, position to gratify his pride or fill his needs at the expense of the needs of the member? Is a leader using any kind of compulsory means to get members to comply with his directives or agree with his interpretations of doctrines or policies? We believe that the abuses recounted here are not simply isolated offenses perpetrated by a few bad leaders, but that the potential for spiritual abuse is systemic in the church. It occurs because of widespread misunderstanding of the gospel of Jesus Christ and because of mistaken ideas about what it means to be a leader in his church. Legalistic interpretations of the gospel lead to an emphasis on obeying rules and looking good. Leaders who believe that they are responsible for maintaining performance and appearance often manipulate and control members to make themselves look good or to fulfill their stewardship as they think God wants them to. Since spiritual abuse is systemic in the church, it must be called to the attention of the entire church. It is not simply a problem for the leaders to solve. Some readers may be asking themselves why these abuses are being made public instead of being dealt with privately or appealed according to church procedures. Our purpose in sharing these stories is to call attention to the problem of spiritual abuse in the church so that the problem can be understood and the remedy applied. They are being given to document the existence of real abuse done to real people. Our purpose is not to embarrass or judge or punish anyone. As you read these stories, we encourage you to empathize with all the people involved and try to understand the beliefs, needs, and feelings that led them to act as they did. These stories are not about bad leaders deliberately acting in abusive ways. They are about leaders who think they are doing the right thing, who act according to their understanding of what their position requires them to do. Yet their actions do not lead to spiritual growth, love, understanding, or peace, the fruits of living the gospel of Jesus Christ. Some readers may believe that this publication is a criticism of church leaders and, as such, violates an important commandment, the commandment to obey and sustain our leaders. However, we are commanded to obey God, not man, and sustaining our leaders does not mean supporting them in unrighteousness or error. One of the signs of an abusive system is having a rule against criticizing or disagreeing with leaders. Evil speaking, shaming, belittling, name-calling, backbiting, in short, speaking for the purpose of hurting someone, is wrong whether we do it to leaders or members. Criticism is not evil speaking. It involves analysis and evaluation, and its purpose is to discover the truth and discern between good and bad, right and wrong, and good and evil. It is a kind of judgment that we as human beings must engage in. For behold, my brethren, it is given unto you to judge, that you may know good from evil. Moroni 7:15. As Christians, we should not judge anyone standing with God, but we can, in a spirit of love, call each other to account for our faults, errors, and offenses. The purpose of making known errors and sins is not to punish, blame, or belittle, but to make the truth known, enable individuals to reconcile their differences, repent, and forgive each other. The scriptures are not silent about the weaknesses, mistakes, and sins of prophets and leaders of the past. The gospel teaches that everyone sins and is in need of repentance. Doctrine and Covenants 121 says that leaders should not use their authority to cover their sins. This means that leaders must be open to criticism and that it is not wrong to disagree with them. Since leaders are to use persuasion, long-suffering, and love to influence us, these are also the ways in which members must try to influence them. Using persuasion implies engaging in a process of discourse where the merits of ideas are discussed, where evidence is considered, and where analysis and evaluation are welcomed. Both leaders and members must do this. Suffering long and loving mean that we continue to love each other even as we disagree. Both leaders and members must do this. Neither leaders nor members may use coercion to force closure. Members very seldom have the ability to use coercion. Leaders not only have the ability to coerce, they can withdraw or withhold callings, take away temple recommends, shame, place members on probation, hold disciplinary councils, or threaten to do so. But they have also shown themselves shockingly willing to use this power in many cases. In many of these cases, the underlying issue has disappeared as the leader has threatened, punished, and coerced to protect his authority. Jesus does not put himself above criticism, and he does not insulate himself from our pain. In dying on the cross, he subjected himself to the judgment of the world, and through prayer, he makes himself accessible to hear our pain, listen to our complaints, and respond to our petitions. The Lord told Oliver Cowdery to admonish Joseph Smith in his faults and also receive admonition of him. This is the principle of reciprocity. We must be mutually accountable to each other. Jesus tells us that if someone offends us, we must go to her and tell her that she has hurt us. This principle recognizes that we do not always know when we have offended someone. It is hard to see our own mistakes. We need each other to liberate us from our egocentricity and narcissism. The one who sees the problem is responsible for reporting it. Whoever feels the pain must voice it. Truth can emerge only when all ideas are open to criticism and people are allowed freedom of belief and speech. In the grace of God's unconditional love, we can have the courage to recognize our problems and admit our weaknesses, acknowledge our mistakes, renounce our false ideas, and confess our sins. Those who are afraid to confront and reveal problems do not seem to understand and have faith in the power of Jesus' love to redeem and reconcile us, and in the power of truth to enlighten and liberate us. Some people believe that openly discussing problems will hurt the image of the church and its missionary efforts. Jesus did not say that his followers would be characterized by their lack of sin or error, but rather by their love for each other. Valuing appearance above reality and putting the needs of the institution before the members' need for spiritual growth are spiritually abusive practices. Our missionary efforts should be focused on building faith in Jesus Christ and teaching his gospel, not on convincing people that the church is perfect and its members are righteous. The reports of spiritual abuse are bad news, but the remedy for spiritual abuse lies in the good news, the gospel of Jesus Christ. Section 121 tells us that it is the nature of almost all people to exercise unrighteous dominion as soon as they get a little authority. As long as there are inequalities and differences, and inequality and difference seem to be a condition of life, we must accept the fact that the potential for abuse exists in all systems and in all human hearts. We must continue to examine our own hearts and to speak the truth in love to each other as we try to love each other and respect each other's agency. As trustees of the Mormon Alliance, we have identified 12 principles that we believe are essential to a spiritually healthy church. The first is love. Love should be the guiding principle in all church governance. A new commandment I give unto you, that ye love one another, as I have loved you, that ye also love one another. John 13:34. Let all things be done in charity. 1 Corinthians 16:14. The second is truth. All church leaders and members should speak the truth in soberness, as they understand it. I know the words of truth are hard against all uncleanness, but the righteous fear them not, for they love the truth and are not shaken. 2 Nephi 9:40. Equality. Every member is entitled to equal respect, dignity, and credibility, regardless of church calling. Let every man esteem his brother as himself. DNC 38:24. He denieth none that come unto him, black and white, bond and free, male and female, and he remembereth the heathen, and all are alike unto God, both Jew and Gentile. 2 Nephi 26:33. Common consent. Common consent is a vote, not a loyalty test. Church leaders are dependent upon the voice of the people for the continuance of the authority, the rights, and privileges they exercise. Quoting from Joseph F. Smith in Gospel Doctrine, for all things must be done in order and by common consent in the church by the prayer of faith, DNC 28:13. And then Joseph F. Smith again, we desire that the brethren and sisters will all feel the responsibility of expressing their feelings in relation to the propositions that may be put before you. We do not want any man or woman who is a member of the church to violate their conscience. We would like all to vote as they feel, whether for or against. Scriptural governance. Church governance should comport with scriptural canon. Thou shalt take the things which thou hast received, which have been given unto thee in my scriptures for a law, to be my law, to govern my church. DNC 45:59. Number 6, openness. Members should have access to all non-privileged information in the custody of the church. Those acting or speaking on behalf of the church should do so openly, not in secret, subject, however, to the priest penitent privilege. Jesus answered him, I spake openly to the world. I ever taught in the synagogue and in the temple, whither the Jews always resort, and in the secret have I said nothing. John 18:29. And this is the condemnation, that light is come into the world, and men love darkness rather than light, because their deeds were evil. John 3:19. 7. Revelatory accountability. Because a prophet does not always speak as a prophet, leaders should disclose what they believe to be the source of their directives, interpretations, and instructions. Correspondingly, members have a right and responsibility to obtain confirmatory revelation. The prophet that hath a dream, let him tell a dream, and he that hath my word, let him speak my word faithfully. Jeremiah 23:28. 8. Tolerance. Criticism and loyal dissent should not be trammeled. Am I therefore become your enemy because I tell you the truth? Galatians 4:16. Church members should be allowed wide latitude for spiritual growth, and leaders should not use their authority to compel conformity. Joseph Smith's words uttered in defense of Pelatiah Brown should be a guiding principle. I never thought it was right to call up a man and try him because he erred in doctrine. It looks too much like Methodism and not Latter-day Saintism. Methodists have creeds, which a man must believe, or be kicked out of their church. I want the liberty of believing as I please. It feels so good not to be trammeled. It doesn't prove that a man is not a good man because he errs in doctrine. Righteous leadership. No priesthood leader should use the priesthood to cover sins, gratify pride or ambition, or exercise control over members in any degree of unrighteousness. Nor should any leader attempt to maintain any power or influence by virtue of the priesthood, except by persuasion, long-suffering, gentleness, meekness, love unfeigned, kindness, and pure knowledge without hypocrisy or guile. Leaders should reprove only when moved upon by the Holy Ghost, and then show forth afterwards an increase of love. Any act undertaken by a priesthood holder in violation of these principles is void. Process. Whenever church disciplinary action is necessary, there should be a consistent and even-handed application of principles of due process and fairness, such as adequate notice, impartial hearing, presumption of innocence, trial by witnesses, evidence examined in its true light, opportunity for defense, and appellate review, all in equality and justice, as required by the Doctrine and Covenants. Responsibility. Church leaders are responsible for their own actions and not those of other members. Church members are responsible for their own actions and cannot escape that responsibility by following church leaders. Brigham Young, I am responsible for the doctrine I teach, but I am not responsible for the obedience of the people to that doctrine. Brigham Young also affirmed the principle of responsibility in these words. I am more afraid that these people have so much confidence in their leaders that they will not inquire themselves of God whether they are led by him. I am fearful they settle down in a state of blind self-security, trusting their eternal destiny in the hands of their leaders with a reckless confidence that is in itself would thwart the purpose of God in their salvation and weaken that influence they could give to their leaders, did they know for themselves, by the revelations of Jesus, that they are led in the right way. Let every man and woman know, by the whisperings of the Spirit of God to themselves, whether their leaders are walking in the path the Lord dictates or not. Number 12 is Christ-like qualities. Church members, church leaders and members alike should serve in their callings and exercise their spiritual gifts with meekness and humility, ready to forgive and be forgiven of sin. The decisions of these quorums are to be made in all righteousness, in holiness and lowliness of heart, meekness and long-suffering, and in faith and virtue and knowledge, temperance, patience, godliness, brotherly kindness, and charity. DNC 107:30. Forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. Matthew 6:12. Moroni accuses the church in the last days of failing in love. Ye do love money and your substance and your fine apparel and the adorning of your churches more than ye love the poor and the needy, the sick and the afflicted. To understand this warning fully, we must interpret it symbolically as well as literally. Moroni uses the symbol of the church building to stand for all aspects of church structure. Adorning the church can be interpreted as trying to build and enhance the church's image. Moroni is thus accusing the church of caring more about protecting its image than meeting the needs of its people, of wanting to project the image of a church of successful, happy people, and thus ignoring the real needs and real problems of its members. Moroni also says, "Why are ye ashamed to take upon you the name of Christ? But ye adorn yourselves with that which hath no life, and yet suffer the hungry and the needy and the naked and the sick and the afflicted to pass by you, and notice them not." When we put the church's programs, procedures, offices, structures, handbooks, and reputation ahead of the people of the church, we are adorning ourselves with that which has no life and refusing to take the name of Christ upon ourselves because he died for each of these people, not for any church structure. His church is his people. Whosoever repenteth and cometh unto me, the same is my church. Followers of Christ will not refuse to notice the afflicted and needy. Instead, they will mourn with those that mourn. They will not simply affirm that proper church procedures have been followed, nor will they accuse them of bringing their afflictions upon themselves. Rather, they will comfort those who stand in need of comfort. The accounts that follow are wounds. They tell the stories of people who have been wounded. The call of a Christian life is still before us. Will we pass by on the other side out of shame? Out of denial, out of fear lest we ourselves also be wounded? Or will we hasten with our wine and our oil to bind these wounds?
Approximately 10 minutes left for questions from the audience. Yes? We'll repeat it in.
I guess the question is if President or Elder McConkie was chastised by the other brethren. That was the rumor that we heard, but we don't know for sure. So, I mean, someone may know, have other information. I don't know.
Yes.
don't you come up here?
Some years ago, I had spent a full afternoon with an individual, I won't name him, who worked under the David O. McKay era as the public relations for the church. He also owned a prominent group of restaurants here in Utah. Anyway, he told me that he had written a letter to, I think it was Jeff Holland at the time, asking if there were the spiritual abuses or excesses committed by your father and his students. And I read this letter in which Jeff Holland said we could find no such evidence that your father was accused of, David. Secondly, this man thought this was such a PR disaster that, having been over the PR of the church for many years, that he knew President Kimball, who was failing at the time, and had spent a lot of time at home. And when he heard when President Kimball was contacted by this source of mine, President Kimball says, "Oh, no." He says, "The world already doesn't think Mormons are Christian, and this will just add to it." And this source was also incensed that he brought formal heresy charges against Bruce McConkie and sent a long certified letter to President Kimball to this effect. From what I can gather, there was no formal heresy charges made against Elder McConkie, but he was rebuked. He was to apologize in general conference, and one of the very last speeches he gave, according to this source, was an effort to clear that matter up. And the priesthood manual for the year, I think the year after this incident happened to your father, was Elder McConkie had pushed a lesson into that manual over at his own insistence to reinforce what he had rebuked your father for. And the following year, that lesson, as I understand it, was taken out. Beyond that, I don't know. I also have some information for you sometime if you'd like to talk about your case.
I think that it's important in cases like what happened to George Pace that if there is any chastisement, and private chastisement is good, I mean, that needs to take place. But in a case like this, it is not rectified if there is not a public announcement, if there is not a public statement made and a public apology, because this was known by many people, and the fact that Brother McConkie may have been chastised privately is not enough. You cannot deal with spiritual abuse like this in just privately when it is known, when many people have been affected. All of those people, as the Doctrine and Covenants says, have a right to be a part of the process of reconciliation too. Yeah, I understand that position, and I disagree with it. It's what I said in my talk. It's putting the reputation of the church above the needs of the members, and it's not right. And I believe that they are even wrong in thinking this helps the image of the church. I think that the church would be better served by showing itself to be compassionate, willing to admit its mistakes, willing to say, "We're sorry." The Catholic Church has done this, and it's been received very well.
They need a couple thousand years, though, before they'll do that. The question is, how did my parents handle the abuse with their children? I don't know what I'm at liberty to say, because I can't speak for them, and you know, this is all a disclosure game in the church right now. You know, who wants so-and-so to know thus and such? And, you know, it's kind of like the homosexual dilemma. You know, do we out people, you know, that don't want to be out of the closet? I will say this, that my parents went through the entire, is the word gamut? Is that the right word?
Spectrum.
Thank you, the spectrum. Of emotions, anger, confusion. And I don't think it was until Elder McConkie passed away personally that there was some peace. And I can't speak for them. I don't know if they have that peace. But it's taken me over 10 years to be able to articulate what it meant to me. And like I say, I can't really speculate what my parents would want me to say about how they dealt with it. But they did. They went through the whole spectrum of emotions for especially the first 2 years after this happened.
One question here and then one back there.
Just by way of explanation, one of the reasons I resigned as a trustee of the Mormon Alliance it was my personal realization that the church is what it wants to be, that it's... Elder McConkie, Elder Packer, general authorities are indeed a reflection of 8 or 9 million people. And as such, I was able to step away from that and for the first time in my life perhaps even accept it for what it is. Those of you who are left in the Alliance, and I'll just ask Janice this, we've talked a little bit about it, how does one respond to 8 million people rather than 100 and something general authorities?
It's a very difficult issue, and it's one that the trustees talked about a lot. Should we focus our efforts at the leaders, or should we focus our efforts on educating the people? My feeling was always that our purpose was mainly to educate, comfort, and help the people of the church. Like Aaron, I see little hope that the authoritarianism that has become worse and worse in the church as years have passed will be helped by our kinds of efforts. But I do believe that, as I have said, the church is not the institution. It is the people, and these are the people of Christ, and I love these people. And I myself am dedicated to helping them understand the gospel of Jesus Christ. And I think that, you know, this is the remedy for spiritual abuse. The church is abusive because it doesn't understand the gospel of Jesus Christ. And now I think we are directing our efforts more. We did try to reach the leaders, as gospel principles tell us, if there is a problem, to go to those who've caused the problem. And we did this. We made sincere and concerted efforts to be able to talk to leaders personally about the problems. We sent them a letter, which they acknowledged but did not respond to. So, it's a difficult issue. Can the church be saved? No, the church can't be saved, but you can, I can. Every person is valuable, and that's my commitment.
I wanted to follow up with, I guess I'm more cynical than Janice. I think that the only way the church is going to respond is in the public forum. That's the only forum that they respect. And that's because they have the most at stake there. They have their image, they have their missionary program, they have this and that. And one of the most exhilarating experiences I ever had was when John Fowler spoke at the rector's forum at St. Paul's on the excommunications. And I happened to be in the audience, and I attended. I was the only non-Mormon there. And I've told this experience before. Excuse me, the only Mormon. And there's a lot of resonance going on in a parish hall when there's a steaming coffee pot in one corner, a crucifix in the other, and a general authority talking about Mormon excommunication to Episcopalians, especially when a Mormon stands up and says, "Let me tell you what I think, and this is how I feel. I'm embarrassed to be a Mormon, and you should too." And that's the only forum that the church is going to respect. That's why silence, keeping silent about something like my father's abuse, is so damaging, because it just buries the angst, and it resurfaces somewhere else, like a very angry flight attendant who's moving to Brooklyn. No, it's not a form of public apology. When you have non-tacit abuse, you have to deal with it non-tacitly. The only response to outrage is outrage. Who said that in the 60s?
I just want to respond quickly to the woman who asked what parents tell their children. When I was abused by the church, of course I went through the gamut of everything, but the thing I would tell my children and did tell them, and I can't say that they all believed it or accepted it, is to choose carefully between right and wrong, and to stand always for what's right, for what your own heart tells you is right, and to stand against, however you have to, the things that are wrong, and against what Christ would do. The bottom line is our relationship with Christ. And even though I don't go to the Mormon Church anymore, and almost all of my children are angry and bitter at the Mormon Church, we are sealed together by the love of Christ eternally. And that's what the gospel's about.